Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is Direct Impact, and this is what we're going to be talking about.
And I'm going to continue to move until we get the total ban on the total initiative relative to what we're going to do with more Border Patrol and more asylum officers.
President Trump?
I really don't know what he said at the end of that sentence. I don't think he knows what he said either.
Donald Trump basically says what the whole world seemed to be thinking as they watched a U.S. president stumble and mumble his way through one of the worst performances in U.S. political history. Painful. Now what? I'm Rick Sanchez. This is Direct Impact. Interestingly enough, I want to start this show by talking about my dad. When my dad got to be into his 80s, like our president, he lost his ability to do many things that he used to. So me and my brothers got together and did what we thought was the responsible thing, to make sure that he didn't humiliate himself, to make sure that he didn't embarrass himself or hurt himself. For example, we took away the keys to his car. It wasn't easy. But you know what? It was necessary. Look, this is my dad. I'm going to show you a picture of him. You see him right there? This is him into his 80s at my son's graduation with my wife and my mom and the rest of our kids. And as you can see, my dad is holding a cane that I remember I had bought him at Walgreens, which he also did not want to use. He said he would be embarrassed to use it. People would think less of him. Just like he didn't want to stop driving, but I told him he had to. But we were eventually able to convince him that this was for his own good, we said, Dad. Now, if we could, let's contrast this to Joe Biden and the decisions that are being made by the people around him, which actually all began when his family, his party, his advisors chose to cancel the primaries so that he could have no competition and no face-to-face time with the media or the public, for that matter. You see, here in the United States, primaries are an essential part of the presidential selection process. It's how the voters get to choose who will represent each party as that party's candidate. Not this year. This year it was canceled. Can you imagine anything more undemocratic than that? Canceling an election, essentially. Then, with Mr. Biden firmly in place, selected, not elected, some of us start to notice that he's looking horribly feeble and looking old. So we said so, right? In fact, we did it right here on the show. I'm going to let you see it again. But he seems confused. Almost seems like he's kind of, like he's losing it. I'll give you some examples. Look at this. This is the president at the G7 summit watching a parachuting exhibition. He appears to just now watch. Keep watching. Watch Biden on the right side of your screen. And as you watch him, you're going to see that he just wanders away. He just starts walking away. Nobody knows why. Finally, the Italian prime minister, watch, she goes and grabs him. That's Meloni. She goes over and grabs him and brings him back. She's like his granddaughter saying, Grandpa, get over here. Yeah, Grandpa, get over here. Well, when we did that, the media and the president's advisors have accused me and others of lying to you. They said we were simply selecting his bad moments. That was a fake video, they called it. And now, this.
Making sure that we're able to make every single solitary person eligible for what I've been able to do with the dealing with everything we have to do with. Look, if we finally beat Medicare, and I'm going to continue to move until we get the total ban on the total initiative relative to what we're going to do with more Border Patrol and more asylum officers.
President Trump?
I really don't know what he said at the end of that sentence. I don't think he knows what he said either.
Wow. That's tough, okay? There it was for the whole world to see. And they did. A president who could barely put a sentence together that made any sense. Let me bring in my partner here, Manila. She's standing by. She saw this as well. And as we get into this, a couple more videos, Manila, you and I stay here, but let's look at these videos together. Here is the president coming out on stage for the very first time. I don't know what you thought when you watched this, but I thought, uh-oh, look at that. I mean, what are you thinking at that point as you're watching him come out on stage?
Gosh, Rick, I mean, how many times do we have to say it? He's just physically and mentally not capable of taking care of himself, it would appear, much less the rest of this country. And Rick, to say that the debates stoked panic among Democratic circles, I think would be an understatement. I mean, first, to the critics who say that we are being ageist, I would say it has nothing to do with POTUS's chronological age, because there are plenty of spry 80-somethings out there, but he ain't one of them,
he
Rick.
Ain't one of them.
Not being ageist is also demonstrated in the weak polling numbers of his vice president, Kamala Harris, as well. I mean, she's young, she's vibrant, even good looking, but nobody thinks that she can do the job of POTUS either.
Here's another video, by the way. I just found this one this morning as I was getting ready to prepare this show. Here's the president getting off the stage. Nobody's seen this one. Forbes had this. Here's the president going off the stage now. This is interesting. His wife comes out and pretends he did a fabulous job when she's, of course, acting. She knows he didn't. There's President Trump walking off the stage, you know, like Mr. Grumbly old man as himself, but obviously a guy who was able to keep it together and have a cogent conversation. But now watch this. Look at him. He's got to take one step, and this is like torturous for him. I mean, you know, there you go. It's the whole thing from beginning to end was tough to watch, and there he is shaking hands. By the way, let's talk about this too. Now, you and I, the media and the many Democrats. The ones who said we were lying, the ones who said we were lying to you, are now having to admit what has become painfully obvious. I mean, it's that it's cruel to allow this president to continue in office for 4 more years. Here's a synopsis of this. Take a look.
If he were CEO and he turned in a performance like that, would any corporation in America, any Fortune 500 corporation in America, keep him on as CEO? We saw last night why this race has been close and why I fear Donald Trump will be the next president of the United States unless things change.
He didn't do well at all. He did not do well at all. We're still far from our convention. And there is time for this party to figure out a different way forward if he will allow us to do that.
It kind of pains me to say this today, but I think President Biden needs to step down and be replaced.
There is a conversation happening inside Biden's circle, and certainly a much more frank conversation happening inside the Democratic coalition. Conversations range from whether he should be in this race tomorrow morning to what was wrong with him.
Maybe he needs to go. Maybe he needs to be honest with himself and the American people. He can bow out at this time with grace and dignity. He has a record he can be proud of.
He believes that he is the only person that can do it. The problem is, after tonight, his party doesn't believe that.
That was right after the debate, where it seemed even the media, the top Democrats, had to admit that, pardon the pun here, but that Joe must go. But wait, not so fast, because already now his advisors are reaching out to their buddies in the media to say, oh, he just had a cold. He overprepared. He was fine the next day. You just had to see him. So why are they doing that? Do they just want to keep their jobs, or do they need him in office because that way they can completely control him, or is it because he just won't step down? Your take, Manila. Why are they doing this?
Well, look, Rick, those talks are confirmed to be happening by various members of Congress, but getting rid of Joe may not be that simple, and here's why. Based on the DNC's own party rules set forth by the party, the rules say that nobody can force the nominee out. The nominee must choose to step aside on his or her own volition. Although we should note that Biden isn't even technically the party nominee yet at this point either. DNC rules say that the person must first win the primaries, which Joe Biden has done, securing roughly 99% of the votes in most U.S. states and territories. Then they have to secure the nomination by getting the majority of votes at the convention from the superdelegates. That's Article 2, Section 3 of the DNC Charter and Bylaws. Now, there are 700 of those superdelegates, the party poobahs, if you will. Yeah. And all that has to happen at the Democratic convention, in this case happening August 19th in Chicago, where then and only then can Joe Biden or whoever can become the official nominee. So right now, technically speaking, Joe Biden isn't even officially the Democratic Party nominee. So they have time to pony up a new face if that's what they're choosing. But they got to convince Biden himself that he's got to quit, Rick.
Pardon me for being a contrarian, but technically speaking, they were supposed to have a primary, too. If they want to do something, they'll find a way to do it, and damn be the laws or their regulations. At least that's how I see it at this point. By the way, speaking of stories that we could call, we told you so, another top Western leader appears to be going down in flames politically. Take a look at these pictures. This is from France over the weekend. Look at this. Wow. Those are tens of thousands of people gathered at the Place de la République in Paris as the polls closed and Marine Le Pen's national rally dominated the first round of the legislative elections in France, signaling what can only be called a repudiation of Emmanuel Macron's policies, including his aggressive, even pro-war positions all over the world, including the South Pacific, the Middle East, Iran, South China Sea, and perhaps the worst of all, suggesting that he wants to send French troops into Ukraine to take on the Russian military. Yeah, that's smart. These are positions it seems the French people are saying they find absolutely unacceptable. Look at this graphic, by the way. This is a snapshot of how well Le Pen's party did. She's the one in purple. She's the one in purple. I mean, a graphic can tell a million stories. Manila, your take?
Yeah, this is absolutely a repudiation, plain and simple. This is a reflection not only of what's happening in France, but across Europe in general. There is a lurch to the right happening in several EU member states. Now, it's not a clear-cut win just yet for Le Pen's national rally. They have another round of voting to go through. But given last month's EU parliamentary election results, which were the catalyst to this snap election we're seeing in France, it shows many Europeans don't have confidence in the direction that their respective countries are going and how the collective is actually faring. That very broadly, Europeans want to see the EU go in a different direction politically. The French are no different. They're unhappy with the cost of living, cost of utilities, the seemingly blind march towards World War III and the guarantee of mutual destruction. They feel that they have given Emmanuel Macron plenty of time to make things right since the days of the Yellow Vest protests, the pre-pandemic protests, and he's failed to deliver. So the voters in France are simply looking elsewhere and willing to overlook even some of the questionable, if not racist, positions that have been held by the National Rally Party and other right-leaning groups, Rick.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, look, there's still another step in the process. We'll see how it goes. But at this point, it does not look good for Mr. Macron. Thanks, Manila. Appreciate it. By the way, another major election taking place. Iran is choosing a leader after President Raisi died recently in a helicopter crash. Is change coming to Iran as well? And if so, what is it? Iranian insider and professor at the University of Tehran, who's joined us in the past, Mohammad Marandi, is going to be joining us in just a little bit. There he is. He's going to be taking us through this to help us understand what this election means. You stay right there, because we're going to be right back. Welcome back again. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I think you're going to recall, because we covered this story at length when it happened, coverage a little more than a month ago, I believe, of President Raisi of Iran when he died in a horrible helicopter crash in some mountains in some bad weather, by the way. Now, there is an election that is taking place right now to replace him. It pits a candidate described as an ultra-conservative against another who is seen by many as a reformer. Now, there they are. That's the reformer, Masoud Pezeshkian, on the left of your screen, and the ultra-conservative, Saeed Jalili, he is on the right. So let's talk about this. And the perfect person to talk about this is someone who's joined us in the past from Tehran, Professor Mohad Mirandi, who's going to help us understand what's going on with this election. Professor, thanks as usual for joining us, sir.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
I've been reading all the Western newspapers, and they're making a big deal out of the fact that 60% of the people in the country did not vote, and they're saying that it was a protest against the current government that they didn't do so. What do you make of that? Is that true? Is there some truth to that?
I don't think so. In the West, no matter what the outcome of the election, it will always be a sign that the people dislike the government or the Islamic Republic or the political establishment. No matter who is elected and what the turnout, it will be presented in a very negative light. If you recall, when President Raisi died in the helicopter crash, the Western media was saying that people in Iran are celebrating. They're all happy that he died. And I was on the BBC actually saying, after they brought in these so-called Iranians living in the West to badmouth him and say people are celebrating, I said, well, when the funerals happen, what are you going to say then when people, millions of people come to the streets? And that's exactly what happened in the city of Tabriz, where the helicopter was going before it crashed. There were huge crowds, unprecedented crowds. Then the funeral moved to Qom, and then to Tehran, the capital, and then to Mashhad. Mm-hmm. You had millions of people on the streets who were mourning the president. So, you know, it's not, doesn't really make sense. The problem, their argument is they're very biased.
Yeah, but you have to admit that they're probably, just like in any country, by the way, this is not a criticism of Iran. I mean, half the people in the United States can't stand both of the guys who are running for president right now. So what does that tell you? However, there is a sense in Iran that two things are at play, it seems to me from my reading, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. A, the economy is horrible for many reasons, including the U.S. sanctions, I understand. And B, people feel, especially the young, like they want to get a little hipper. They want to modernize the country a little bit. They want to make some changes, which might be why they're attracted to the reformist candidate. What did I get wrong there?
Well, there are a couple of issues here. That would be a very paradoxical position to take by the Western media, because if the young want the reformist candidate, then the turnout would have been much higher.
Huh.
The problem is that these six candidates, two of whom were reformists and four were from the so-called conservative or principalist camp, who themselves were very diverse, none of them were very appealing. There were 20 hours of debates, but none of them stood out. President Raisi was a person who stood out, and he became very popular among ordinary Iranians. Presidents before him also were usually very charismatic and more or less popular. But these six gentlemen, no matter how good they may have been in their work, in their previous positions, but none of them appealed a great deal to the voters. The debates were actually quite boring. So
interesting.
The turnout was low, largely because none of the candidates was able to connect with the public.
Well, as we look at some of the video of some of these people voting, interestingly enough, we're seeing video probably chosen by somebody in the West that only has people in burqas. Of course, just so people know, not everybody in Iran walks around in a burqa. But regardless of that, I'm wondering, and I think this is a really important question that I want to understand. Let's suppose the reformist candidate, or he's called the reformist candidate, and the other guy's called the ultra-conservative. Those are labels, and we need to stay away from them. But there they are, just to be able to separate these two men. Let's talk about Pezeshkian, if I pronounced his name correctly. I hope I did. They call him the reformist. What happens if he wins? What changes? What does reform look like?
It's hard to say. He is a moderate reformist. Because the reformist camp is very broad. Some of them are very unpopular. The president before Mr. Raisi, Dr. Rouhani, he was not a popular person. Mm. And now one thing that is weighing down Dr. Pezeshkian, who is a heart surgeon, is President Rouhani, the person who ran the country before Dr. Raisi. Mm. So the reformist camp, it's not as if the reformist camp is a monolith, and it's not as if they are more popular. I think the first round showed, actually, that none of the political factions are terribly popular. And it also revealed that none of the candidates turned out to be very charismatic. As I said, the debates were boring. And while they had very diverse views, Mr. Pezeshkian was saying that we should work harder to revive the nuclear deal. He is more optimistic about trying to improve the relationship with the United States. And you would expect, based upon those narratives that you hear in the Western media, that young people would turn to him. But that really didn't happen. On the other hand, both of these candidates actually are similar in one respect. And that is that the conservative or the principalist, Mr. Jalili, Dr. Jalili, he is a sort of social justice warrior. But the same is true about Dr. Pezeshkian. Both of them speak about the poor, the disenfranchised, those who've been left behind. Of course, Mr. Pezeshkian has a problem because part of the reformists are often liberal, pro-business. And so there's a sort of paradox again here, where on the one hand, he speaks as a social justice warrior, and he does have credentials for that. But many of his backers are big business people and liberals and that sort of thing. So the camps are fragmented. The camps are not, it's not clear what the camps stand for. And I think that confusion, but also the fact that they don't have that much charisma.
What should they, I got to ask you, what should they stand for? If you, and nobody knows Iran as well as you do, I think you're the guy to go to for an explanation of the heartbeat of the country in many ways. What would you suggest they should stand for? What is the thing that can help Iran become a better Iran? And how much of that has to do with maybe trying to make peace with the West somehow, as difficult as that might be to put your hand out to somebody who's been beating you over the head with a hammer for so long?
Well, actually, I think there are two things. One was the policy pursued by Dr. Raisi, and that was expanding ties with the Global South, joining BRICS, joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, also continuing to engage with the West. We had negotiations over the nuclear deal 2 years ago, and we almost reached a deal. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it's the economy. 90% of Iranians are focused on the economy. In the polls, it's all about jobs, inflation, and the economy. And other issues, foreign policy, cultural issues, social issues, these are way down among priorities. They're important, but it just shows how the economy is important today. And so far, none of them seem to have shown the people that they're the ones who will provide the solutions. However,
30 seconds left. I have to ask you this question. Do the people see the economic problems as something self-made by the leadership, or how much? Or do they see it completely as a representation of the horrible sanctions imposed by the United States of America?
I think just like in Western countries, they believe that the government is inefficient, but also the issue of sanctions is very important. But tonight and tomorrow night, and as we speak, there's a debate going on, and tomorrow night there will be a denied, and there will be a debate, and they are both one-on-one. So these two candidates have an opportunity to get their ideas across to the public, and maybe one of them will click.
Interesting. You are such a delight to talk to. You always seem to have your finger on the pulse of what's going on in your country, and we appreciate being able to have this conversation with you. We'll be watching it, and hopefully we'll get you back, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Professor. And that's our show. And remember to always look outside your own box, because as we like to say is the mission of our show, truths don't live in boxes. I'm Rick Sanchez. We'll be looking for you next time.